We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you by Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Okay, it's a pleasure to introduce Yael Unterman, who I just met last night. Yes, you'll hear in one moment, she grew up in the UK, has been living in Israel for 19 years, and has spent the last while working on really a magnum opus on the Chamelibus, who I had the... You are too young to really have had her as... I had her as a teacher when I, you know, I was had the privilege of having her for a year when I was in Gruss, but really it's... just looking through it, I picked this up on Friday. It's a wealth of information, and of course, this is the subject of her talk. She's Yael is a creative writer, has a degree in Jewish history in Talmud, and she's is teaching. And it's a pleasure to have her here in Toronto to talk on the Chamelibus and how she revolutionized the study of Tanakh. Yael.
Done. Okay, I'm not as young as you think I am. I want to thank Rabbi Jake Hellman for...
I don't think there are enough for everybody.
Okay, we'll take one between two. Okay, shh. I do want to thank Rabbi Jake Hellman for allowing me the opportunity to speak here in Toronto. It's been a long time since I've sort of stayed upon the soil of Canada for more than a few minutes passing through Toronto Airport, so this has been a pleasure. And... I have written a book on the Chamelibus. It's a labor of about 10 years. It's been an incredible journey for me. And I'm here to share with you today small segments of her biography and then an analysis of a couple of aspects of her life and work. Of course, I could go on for hours. The book does have 600 pages in. So I've deliberately chosen to focus on a couple of the aspects. So... Professor Leibowitz, or Nechama, as she insisted on being called by all, was a model of Jewish greatness and an unusual model, certainly then and even nowadays, of female Jewish greatness. She was the first widely accepted female Torah scholar that we've ever had, and she was the most famous teacher of Torah and commentaries in the 20th century, and one might say of all time. She changed the way that Tanakh was studied by developing probing approaches to the commentaries, comparing them and analyzing them deeply, when previously they had been studied rather superficially and without much understanding. You know, the mitzvah of studying, you know, the weekly portion with Rashi, you read through the Rashi, how much understanding do you really have of what's going on for Rashi? Nechama made us stop, look, think, and ask. And many thousands of people were influenced by her. I like at this point to have a show of hands. Who here studied personally with Nechama Leibowitz? Personally? Okay. Who here studied only with a student of Nechama Leibowitz, but that way got her methodology also? All right. Who here has Nechama Leibowitz's books on their shelf? Okay, you see. Anybody here filled out Nechama Leibowitz's worksheets? There's always one or two. Oh, fabulous. Okay, we'll tell you about the worksheets in a minute, those who don't know what they are. So as you see, just by this particular sample, how many people Nechama must have impacted around the world through her classes and her books and her worksheets. And I like to note that she's an example of someone who could have a tremendous influence on society to actually cause a revolution without being at all political. Being actually anti-political in many ways. And that's an important note for those of us who don't really like politics that much. Now, I'm going to give you a short overview of her biography, and then we'll examine aspects in depth. So, Nechama Leibowitz was born in September 1905 in Riga, Latvia. As many of you may know, she had an older sibling called Yeshayahu. Actually, in Israel, he's the more well-known of the two, and I find that abroad, Nechama is the more well-known. He went on to become one of Israel's foremost philosophers, a visionary considered by some. Other people consider him an obstinate and harmful public figure. It depends on the aspect that you take. Now, their family background was a very cultured one. The father was a timber businessman, but he was fluent in both Tanakh and Shakespeare, and he would quiz them very much quizzed them on both. I think if the Chidon HaTanach had existed then, they would have been multiple winners. He was also strongly pro-Zionist and spoke Hebrew at home to the children. And these influences can be seen very clearly in both of their developments. Now, in 1919, due to upheavals in Latvia, the family was forced to uproot to Berlin. Berlin at the time was the center of the world in terms of intellect, culture, and both Jewish and German, and it was an excellent place for Nechama to develop and stretch herself. This was a golden age for the Jews, and just like, unfortunately, the Spanish golden age, it was about to be burst by the horrors of the succeeding decade. The city was swarming at the time with Jewish intelligentsia. We could name Abraham Joshua Heschel, Isaac Huttner, Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the Sridi Eish, and also two of the greatest Jewish personalities of the 20th century, and I'm referring to Rabbi J.D. Soloveitchik and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and they were all there at the time. There were people who just loved the idea of all these people meeting up, and they would insist that Nechama had met the Rebbe and Rav Soloveitchik, but she would say, it may be that we ate in the same cafe, but we never actually met. Now, Nechama attended the universities of Berlin, Heidelberg, and Marburg. She studied English and German philology and literature, also Bible studies with many of the renowned scholars at the time. Of course, the emphasis of the Bible studies at the time was strongly biblical, critical, historical, which Nechama loathed. So that was what she was studying at the time. And by the age of 25, she had earned her doctorate on the topic of Yiddish Bible translations in the 15th and 16th centuries. And she also studied Jewish studies at an advanced level at the Hochschule. Now, something that's not known by everyone and is really the most unusual piece of information about Nechama Leibowitz's life is that she was married to her uncle, who was 29 years older than herself. So she was 25 and he was 54 when they got married. Not everyone was happy about the match, but subsequently rumors flew around that Nechama had married him. He became an invalid, he went blind, and so people claimed that, of course, she married him just in order to take care of him without having any halachic problems of, you know, Yichud or Negiah, but that wasn't true. From the research that I've done and others have done, it does seem that she married him for the same reason as most of us get married, which is for love. And she had 40 happy years with him before he passed away in the mid-70s. Now, in 1930, the couple immigrated to Palestine, to Eretz Yisrael, and Nechama immediately began teaching in various programs and to various populations, religious, secular, kibbutzniks, urban dwellers, old and young, and flying around the country and teaching soldiers. She entered academia, first of all Bar-Ilan University in its early days, which she had to leave under a little bit of a cloud, not of her making, but somebody else's, which you can read about in the book. And then she went to Tel Aviv University, where she was eventually appointed professor of Bible education, which is a whole other topic as well, why of Bible education and not of Bible, okay? But we won't go into that right now. It's an important topic. Nechama won the prestigious Israel Prize for Education in 1957, and she lived and worked in Jerusalem until she passed away in 1997, at the grand old age of 92. Now, Nechama was fiercely Zionist. She didn't leave Israel for the last six decades of her life, and she would insist that everyone had to speak Hebrew, and she would make fun of the American rabbis who would come to her, and she would tell them that their Hebrew was much worse than the Hebrew of the Japanese Makoya sect, who was a Judeo-philic sect who they studied in Hebrew, and the American rabbis seemed to think that God had said in English, "Let there be light," and Nechama would laugh at them. Nechama was, as I said to you, flying around the country. She became a popular teacher, but her life's work really began with the worksheets, the Gilyonot. Now, what were these worksheets? Well, Nechama was teaching a group of immigrant girls in their 20s and 30s, mature students who had come on their own without their parents from Vienna and Germany to escape the Nazis, and whose education was full of holes, and they were making it up, their Jewish education. During the year, Nechama had given them these sheets with questions on the weekly portion and on the commentaries on the weekly portion. And then, in the summer, the girls went back to the kibbutzes on which they were dwelling, and then a miracle occurred that has never before happened in human history and will never again happen. And that was that the students contacted her and said, "Nechama, we miss you. We'd like more homework." Okay? Any of you who are teachers, I would like to hear from you. Have any of your students phoned you up and said, "Please, I'm bored. Give me some homework during the summer?" I didn't think so. Okay, so these they contacted and they said, Nechama, please, we love your sheets. We loved filling them out every week. Can we fill them out now during the summer? So Nechama said, you want to learn Torah? I'll do it, you know. Nobody was paying her for this extra time, but she said, of course. And then something interesting happened, which is also very unusual. These girls were filling out the sheets with great gusto, and their friends saw and said, ooh, we want to also. So Nechama began to receive requests from complete strangers. Please, can we have your homework? And Nechama said, people want to learn Torah, of course. And she began to send out these sheets to these complete strangers. Well, long story short, the word spread. It spread off these kibbutzim to secular kibbutzim and to cities and eventually abroad to people in Morocco and in America. And eventually Nechama was basically receiving hundreds of letters every week, right, in which these people would fill out the worksheet that she'd sent out, send it back to her, and she would check it in red pen and write personal comments. And sometimes the comments were things like, where did you get this rubbish from? And, you know, very direct and blunt. And then she'd send them back to the people. Okay, so she was this one-woman correspondence course. And she was basically having to find every spare minute of free time that she could, you know, be it on a bus, you know, taking out, or at night, taking out a little flashlight in a waiting room till 2 o'clock in the morning, because she was marking all of this this homework, and all of it completely unpaid, which is incredible. And I like to say also that we're familiar with the shut, the Sheilot HaTshuvot, the responsa, whereby Jews from around the world would send their questions into a learned scholar, and he would send out the answers. And Nechama turned it around. She sent out the questions and everybody else sent their answers back in. So that was that very special experience, and I'm sure those in the room who filled out those questionnaires and sent them to her just found it an incredible experience to have Nechama, the Nechama Leibowitz, writing to them every week. Nechama Leibowitz's mailbox was 4 times the size of her neighbor's. She would recycle envelopes. You'd receive an envelope that had been sent in by someone else. You know, it was, you know, she would pull in her father and the neighborhood children to you know, fold it all in. It was really a huge endeavor. She really was a one-woman open university. And that's really an example of her incredible dedication. So what was it about these sheets that's so fascinating? It was the challenge. Rather than demonstrating her own erudition, Nechama made the people sweat over these sheets. They were like puzzles. They were riddles. People wanted to answer her questions. They had to examine the verse and the section and the chapter carefully. Then they had to read the commentaries under discussion and then answer the questions that Nechama posed, which were of the type, what is the difficulty that Rashi or the other commentary is addressing? What is the difference between one explanation and another? Why was a particular commentator not completely satisfied with his own answer, and why did he give additional ones? Now, to some of us today, those questions might sound somewhat banal. What's so exciting about that? But that's because we are the product of Nechama Leibowitz. So we're used to hearing things like that. But for people who were reading these commentaries with very little understanding and in a very superficial way, they made us stop and think, and they knew that Nechama had an answer in her mind, and you wanted to guess what it was. So Nechama also, importantly enough, on these sheets, cited a range of materials, Tanakh, Talmudic and Midrashic materials, commentators from before Rashi through recent rabbinic literature, the ethical teachings of the Muslim movement, and contemporary religious philosophy, and occasionally she would also cite a non-Orthodox or non-Jewish source. She made accessible many sources that otherwise would only have been available to somebody who could have gone to the National Library in Jerusalem, as she did, and dig through these manuscripts. So subscribers to her worksheets received what amounted to an excellent introduction to Jewish thought across the ages, with the exception of one realm, the realm of Hasidut and Kabbalah, which didn't really wasn't Nechama's thing. She just didn't go there. She would say, I don't understand. You get the feeling she didn't connect to it. She was Germanic. She was a Yekki, and these strange esoteric texts weren't exactly her thing. And she was honest enough and modest enough not to pretend that she knew about those. It has been said that Nechama did for the commentaries what Kehati did for the Mishnah and Steinsaltz did for the Talmud. Now, these sheets began to be distributed in the diaspora. Eventually, they were turned into pamphlets, and those pamphlets became the books that many of us know, the studies in the weekly portion that sit on bookshelves from Jerusalem to Guatemala, and are studied by Jews and non-Jews alike. There is an 80-year-old nun in Jerusalem called Sister Morina, who's created a program for Christians to study Parashat HaShavua. And when they go home to their home communities, she hands them one of Nechama's books and they take it home to teach their home communities. And that was something, one of the interesting little nuggets that I discovered. One of the good things about writing this book over the span of 8, 9, 10 years was there was time to discover these like little cute nuggets of information. Now these books, if you've seen them, were masterpieces. They were very well organized. They were crafted and polished essays. She had taught the art of essay writing in her earlier years, so it's not surprising. Fairly self-sufficient, laid out very clearly, key biblical verses, words in bold, the difficulty stated, followed by various solutions from classic and modern interpreters, together with Nechama's own elucidation, and we'll talk about that. And it was all in down-to-earth language. She brought concrete examples. There were footnotes. And then at the end, there would be a summing-up paragraph which was her own words, and it would encapsulate the approach that best solved the problem according to the Pshat as she saw it, but also a message for mankind. And occasionally there'd be a tension between those two levels because they're not the same thing. And in doing so, in creating a work that collated material and laid it out so clearly, Nechama was to an extent following in the footsteps of such Jewish giants as Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, who took dispersed halachic material and laid it out as a set table. And one of my interviewees, Professor Yaakov Kagan, says that Nechama was like an orchestrator, a conductor who's been given a huge, magnificent work and a full symphony orchestra consisting of hundreds of virtuoso solos, most of whom have never interacted with each other. And her method of dealing with this challenge is to select the most significant passages and spotlight those soloists who play them most brilliantly. Okay, that was the introduction. Now I'd like to move on to Nechama's relationship with femininity and feminine identity. I think it's very interesting. So we must address, first of all, the novelty of a prominent female Torah scholar. Now, the famous Israeli author Shmuel Yosef Agnon opens his story, The Wisdom of Women, with the following. There lived in the city a great woman of good lineage, and she knew scripture and Mishnah, Midrash, Halachot, and Agadot. And she had discussions with the Torah scholars in the Bet Midrash. Now, as the story proceeds, the denizens of this Bet Midrash, perturbed by the woman's presence in their midst, place an attractively bound volume on the shelves entitled The Wisdom of Women. Elated, the woman leafs through it, only to discover blank. Every page is blank. The men laugh loudly at her. Although furious, she is forced to admit that the blame begins with her female predecessors for leaving no written legacy of Jewish wisdom. Now, in Agnon's story, the wise woman ends up writing stories to fill the book. Agnon's imagination, seemingly, could not stretch to encompass a female Torah scholar. And yet, right there in front of his eyes was the very woman who would prove him wrong. And in fact, he knew her personally. In 1943, when this story was printed, Nechama had already launched the worksheets that would eventually lead to these first volumes of Torah scholarship, written by a woman. After this, The Wisdom of Women could never again be considered a blank book. Now, Nechama, the irony is that we have to say that Nechama would certainly have been less captivated by a book entitled The Wisdom of Women than by a book entitled The Close Study of Tanakh and Approaches of Its Commentators Throughout the Ages. That's what would have intrigued her. This was another book that was fairly blank, and those were the pages that she filled with great industry, and that is significant. Now, Nechama herself denied her gender any importance in her scholarship. She said, I did not realize at all that my being a woman would be a factor in the acceptance or rejection of my worksheets. Yet, it may have played a larger role than she gave it credit for. Women have frequently been intellectual pioneers in Jewish history. Frequently, but they certainly have at times. And as a woman, she was able to bring together diverse religious and secular elements without raising eyebrows because no one expected her to have a beard. No man could have taken on her role. He would either have had to belong to the academic or to the yeshiva world, but less was expected of Nechama. She was not considered an enemy of the yeshiva world. And I have to tell you that even today, even in the past 24 hours, you know, the sentence has come out of my mouth and the mouths of people I've been talking to, and the sentence is, people care less about women. Okay, I kind of made a quip that had I been a man, I might have merited to be excommunicated by someone, but no one's bothering because I'm a woman. And it's still true to an extent, which leaves us with more freedom. And there's something good about that, because I don't really want to be excommunicated. Now, another result of Nechama's not having studied in yeshiva was that she was less bound by regular study methods. She was freer to introduce elements such as literature and drama, etc. Furthermore, although Tanakh scholars did exist when Nechama began her teaching, of course, all male, by and large, traditional Jewish men at the time were studying Talmud. Okay, they were studying Talmud. That was considered the superior field, and Tanakh was definitely came a far second. And in the meantime, the women who could study Tanakh were not yet educated to the kind of level that could bring very keen and erudite scholarship to Tanakh, in which case, between these two poles, there was a huge vacuum into which Nechama stepped very elegantly with the exact right combination of traits, and she conquered the entire field. She succeeded in counteracting some deeply held prejudices against women's capabilities in the yeshiva world. A well-known rabbi who I think even became the head of the RCA at some point, and I won't tell you his name, you have to look in my book. he reported to me personally that when he was a young man studying in the Gruz Kollel in Jerusalem, his rabbi said to him, "You must go learn with Nechama Leibowitz." And he said, "A woman? What could I possibly learn from a woman? I've been in Rav Soloveitchik's shiur." But the rabbi said, "You've got to go learn with this woman." So he called her up. They found a time when she could meet him. He came in, he sat down, and she gave him one of her worksheets. Now, the worksheets had easier questions, and then harder questions with one X, and even harder questions with two X's. This rabbi starts to work through the questions. He gets to the X, starts to sweat, and gets to the two X. He can't answer it, and he realizes that he should put himself down a notch or two. And from then on, he developed a relationship with Nechama Leibowitz and became a fan. And I'm absolutely sure that he never saw women's learning in quite the same way again. Another story tells, and there are many stories, there are stories that tell of men who used to sneak in the back of her classroom to a group of women in a reversal of the usual Yentl scenario. And even a story of one day she was teaching a group of women, young women, that contained also graduates of the Beis Yaakov ultra-Orthodox system. And suddenly a well-dressed ultra-Orthodox man comes into her room and says, "May I sit in on the class?" And she says, "Okay." He sits down, and at the end he comes up to her and says, "I'm the father of one of your students, and I read my daughter's notes and could not believe it was given by a woman. I had to come and see it with my own eyes." Now, was Nechama a feminist? Now, according to her words alone, the answer is a resounding no. She really can be said to be an anti-feminist. She rejected feminist materials given to her by her friends, Blue Greenberg, Hannah Safrai, and other notable feminists. She felt it was a secular movement. However, her actions speak in a different tone, because she achieved more for women's Torah learning than many feminists actually did, and she opened many, many doors. Now, in general, feminist readings take one of two broad focuses. Either they look at the absence of women's voices in the text and the negative attitudes towards women, or they try and make a positive emphasis, amplifying and celebrating women's presence as much as possible. While Jewish observant women have been involved in both these approaches, it is more difficult to join in with an explicit critique of sacred texts, the so-called hermeneutics of suspicion. Such readings, often unsympathetic, might appear to devout people to really distort the scripture's meaning. And therefore, the second activity of celebrating and amplifying female activity in the Torah is often adopted. But Nechama, who did not see herself as a female scholar, but rather a scholar who happened to be female, she did neither kind of reading. She was never critical of the Torah's approach to women, and she was unconcerned with female power or legal approaches to women. She almost never paid attention to the gender of the personalities in the Tanakh as an issue in itself. She deals little, if at all, with female identity, whether within halacha, issues such as women's Torah learning, the laws of nida, marital laws, the laws of the aguna, the chained wife, etc., or in the psychological realm, such a woman's independent existence, the search for partnership, motherhood, infertility, or being a female in a male-dominated world. There's no doubt that Nechama was against the abusive treatment of women, but it's more accurate to say that Nechama opposed all abuse and injustice. She writes, "The Torah was not concerned with favoring one side or according privileges to the other. It does not underwrite the privileges of a particular class, but is concerned with human welfare." And much can be learned about her real attitude from the story of the rape of Dina. In her study of this story, she chooses to focus on Jacob and the brothers rather than on Dinah. And most significantly, she criticizes the brothers, Dinah's defenders, for their violence. Okay, so she felt she was on that side of the story. At times, Nechama seems to be actively avoiding granting the biblical women any sort of three-dimensional existence. An interesting example is that of Potiphar's wife. Both the Midrash and Thomas Mann, whose book Joseph and his brothers Nechama greatly esteemed, wrote about the human face of Potiphar's wife. Nechama, however, ignores the social and emotional aspects. She doesn't even bother to demonize this character as the eternal female seductress. She is instead entirely focused on Joseph's restraint and righteousness in the face of temptation. Potiphar's wife is no more than the embodiment of his test and of the foreign cultures that will forever threaten the Abrahamic faith. Even more startling is her sidelining of the daughters of Tzelafchad, whose story is replete with drama and educational messages. They take on both only the most fleeting of cameo roles in her studies, whereas in that week's portion, she actually devotes no less than 3 essays to the week's Haftorah. Nechama disliked, as I said, the feminist theory that she read, and she certainly parted way with the feminists when it came to ritual, okay? Wearing tzitzit, talit, laying tefillin. In her view, this was an absurd modern innovation and not the result of authentic religious emotion. She rejected all actions that were not normative and customary. For example, she would not speak from the bima in a synagogue, feeling this undermined its sanctity and was not an appropriate place for a woman. And she was very outspoken on this issue. Had women, she would demand rhetorically, fulfilled all their obligations that they needed to now go and take on some more? What need did they have for a black box on their head if God had not told them to do so? Far better that they should go and visit the sick. Far more difficult to listen to some kvetchy invalid complaining than to wrap straps around your arm. However, when we look at what Nechama did in practice and how she empowered both herself and other women in Torah learning, Nechama may go down in Jewish history as the anti-feminist with the most positive impact on women's lives. In her influence on orthodox female intellectual life, she is rivaled by only one other woman, and that is, of course, Sarah Schneerer, the founder of the Beis Yaakov movement, who also probably would have shuddered at the title feminist, although I don't know for sure. So for Nechama, Torah study was an absolutely natural activity for women, and she stood up for this principle whenever it was undermined. She did away with the myth that women are incapable of becoming Talmidot Chachamot, Torah scholars. Clearly, women were unqualifiedly capable of scholarship, and Torah study was a natural activity for them. She acted as if no obstacles even existed. When 2 female students approached her saying, "We'd like to come to Israel, but what can we do here for a living as women?" she replied, "Well, I'm a woman. I teach Torah." As with all her firmly held beliefs, Nechama stalwartly defended this view. On one occasion, a well-known rabbi came to address a group of Nechama's students, all male except for one woman who'd had special permission to attend. The rabbi saw the woman and said, "I will not teach until she goes out." Nechama gathered her things and began to get up. The rabbi said, no, until she goes out. Nechama said, "I understood you perfectly, but if she leaves, I leave." Nechama supported initiatives that created an entree for women into the world of Talmud and Halacha. And she was in favor of programs to train women as rabbinic pleaders or to study Talmud, even though she herself only knew Talmud piecemeal. Though she dressed very modestly and adhered to the orthodox dress code, she lived her life as an extremely public figure. Her personality was the very opposite of reserved. She didn't let any false societal notions of modesty stand between her and her dearest goal of Torah teaching. In her classroom, she was in charge, speaking her mind no matter who the students were. She taught in front of men with a manner far from meek. On the contrary, it was outgoing and even theatrical. And it's marvelous to see that no matter how much time Nechama spent outside her home, traveling the country, teaching in front of hundreds of men and women, no matter how little time she spent in her kitchen, and really she barely knew how to boil an egg, she was still praised repeatedly with the verse representing the ideal of Jewish female modesty, Kol Kvoda Bat Melech Pnima, the honor of the king's daughter is inside. The muted colors and conservative style of her clothing had something to do with this. Being the very opposite of provocative or alluring, they broadcasted a message of piety. She was sufficiently covered up for a society that often measures the devoutness of its women in terms of extra centimeters on sleeves and skirts. But beyond such judgments of fabric length and color, her clothes also reinforced the clear impression that Nehama's purpose in all these travels and teaching was not one of self-aggrandizement, and she did not want the focus to be on her. Nehama even took on aspects of the rabbinical role. She was never a halachic decider, but because she knew so much, people would occasionally ask her halachic questions. The respect in which she was held made people feel like she was their rabbi, and Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein did say to his students they must stand up when she walked in the room just as they would for any rabbi. And how did Nehama manage to achieve what no other Jewish woman before her had? And I'll just say in one sentence, I make a comparison between Nehama Leibowitz and Reina Batya, who was a very interesting figure who was married to the Netziv of Volozhin. And she desperately, Reina Batya desperately wanted to learn Torah and really rejected the domestic life. Her poor husband went, you know, without any cooked meals. And she was very miserable because she didn't find an outlet for her desire for Torah study. And it's very interesting to compare her with Nehama and to ask why did Nehama's story end up so different. In trying to explain how Nehama came to be the strong woman she was, her background may have played a part. Here's the father teaching her Tanakh alongside her brother, you know, growing up with these brilliant men around her, and that may well have prepared her to be who she was. On the other hand, growing up in the shadow of this very, very intelligent older brother may have created insecurities in her, and she may have become who she was despite growing up in that particular family. We don't know a lot about her mother. Apparently, she was quite a strict figure, and she would say things to Nehama like, if you dress like that, you'll never get married. So Nehama showed her by marrying the uncle. And Nehama also spoke of a grandmother who she claimed could study a page of Talmud competently and used to discuss Torah with the rabbis of Lithuania. However, the fact that Nehama also never had children was significant in making her domestic life secondary. It enabled her to teach and travel freely, which surely contributed to her career advance. It's interesting that several prominent Jewish women of today were either single or childless, for example, Henrietta Solt and Zara Schneira. So, without making any definitive statements on this subject, obviously the time and energy a childless woman may devote to her projects is greater. But even beyond the practicality of time constraint lies the issue of a woman's self-image. Does the woman see herself as spending her life preparing for motherhood and then becoming a mother and then becoming a grandmother, etc.? Or does her identity push her to embrace other realms of achievement unrelated to the mother role? This duality is touched upon in a Torah piece that Nehama made famous. She included it in her studies, she taught it frequently, and if people would invite her to give a lecture on women's issues, she preferred to teach this piece instead. The piece in question is the explanation by Rabbi Isaac Araman, known as the Akedat Yitzchak, a 16th century commentator, of Genesis 31, where we see, and please turn now to your source sheet, okay, Vatere Rachel, ki lo yalda li Yaakov, vatekane Rachel ba'achota, vatomer li Yaakov, hava li banim, vim ayin meta anochi. ויחר אף יעקב ברחל ויאמר התחת אלוהים אנוכי אשר מנע ממך פרי בטן. So Rachel is imploring her husband Jacob, give me children, and if not, מתה אנוכי. I am dead in some way. And Jacob's response to this plea is one of anger. And let's stop and look at this for a second. There are two primary questions here. The first one is, how do we understand Rachel? And for that, we have to look at her words. What does it mean? Give me children, and if not, I am dead. How do you understand that?
She'll have no one to replace her.
I have no one to replace me, but why am I then dead? Because I have no continuation? My life stops at the end of my life. There's no chain of continuity. How else could we understand it? Rachel, we're talking about Rachel now. I don't know if Rachel would have students. It's not the kind of thing that I think was in that context at the time. Yes?
A lack of purpose
in my life. Death as in no meaning, no vitality. What am I living for if I can't give everything I have to my children? So, of course, I'm alive, but only physically. What else could it mean? I am dead, yes.
I'm going to commit suicide.
I might commit suicide, okay, because this is just the suffering is unbearable, or...
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Dead, okay, because, you know, the rabbis say there are several people considered as dead, a poor person, a leprous person, a wicked person, and it's kind of unfair, you know, why should the poor person be considered dead? But you're pointing out that in the eyes of society, these people might be so lowly that they're considered nothings. Did you want to add something? Yes?
Well, I just wanted to say that other people will just discount her and never ask her opinion, never solicit her, as if they ignore her like she's a ghost.
So you're expanding on what we just said about how unsubstantial a person who isn't doing what she's supposed to be doing in society might end up becoming. Okay. So Rashi says, he goes with, I am like dead, for whoever is childless is like dead. Doesn't quite explain exactly how. Ramban says, or I will kill myself from suffering. Now, regarding Jacob's reaction, how do you understand his somewhat violent response? Here is his beloved wife, Rachel, who he loves and has worked for 14 years. And she's coming and saying, I want children. This is terrible. And he says, well, am I in place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? What kind of response is that? So how do you understand that? Yes.
I don't think he was angry at her. I think that she was
triggering his. So you were reading the verse, Vayichar Af. Well, it's a little difficult because it does say, Vayichar Af Yaakov Berachel, and Jacob's anger was kindled Berachel. Now, maybe if we translated it as because of Rachel rather than against Rachel, we could go with your. Right. I think that your words are very psychologically profound, but I would suggest that we have no need to ignore our text or subvert it, but that actually the bet of Berachel might mean because of Rachel. It's a little bit further than to actually say it was against Rachel, but I think I personally am a believer that if we're reading a text, we shouldn't just do a Humpty Dumpty on it and make up things randomly, because that's, we're trying to be in dialogue with the actual text that we have. So let's reinterpret where it is possible. Who else would like to tell me about Yaakov's reaction? What do you think about it?
Right.
And the sages, Chazal, no less, say, they go with your lines and they say, the Holy One, blessed be He, says, is this the way to answer the troubled? It's the same thing. What kind of insensitive reaction is that? God, the sages put into God's mouth this rebuke to Yaakov. Anybody else? Anyone? Yes. As a married couple, what was their primary goal?
To be engaged in a life together.
In other words, he loved her and he wanted her to value their own marriage. And when she was walking around going, if I don't have children, I might as well be dead, it insulted him on the level or made it pain him, because he thought that their marriage had a value to it and should give her meaning and purpose in her life. Very much reminiscent of the words of who? I was actually, why Manoach? That's Elkanah. That's exactly who I was thinking of. Right.
Uh-huh.
That's right. What does he say? He says,
aren't I better than 10
sons? And she goes, no. All right. And that's very interesting insight there on those two stories. Anybody else on Yaakov's violent, somewhat seeming angry reaction? Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that's what Jacob is saying. This is a divine business we're into. And even though the language you put it is criticized, but basically he's saying to her, look, this is God's plan. And I can't help it. I can't help what's going on.
If we're going to be patriarchs and matriarchs dedicated to the service of God, we need to accept what God does in our lives and the way that he handles it. Yes? Right, exactly. Right. Right, and actually we could deduce that maybe Rachel is turning to him and saying, do for me what your father did for your mother. And she's saying, but he's taking it a step further and saying, why are you turning to me? You need to do your own praying. Maybe my father prayed for my mother, but you are a more liberated woman and you need to do your own praying. Maybe that's another way that we could read it. Last one on this, yes.
Just like Yaakov Nina is so irritating to Hannah that she is forced to get up and appeal to God. So maybe that's what Yaakov is doing here for his wife.
Provoking her to the point where she'll have to grow. Pushing her beyond her comfort zone. Okay, it's a positive way of seeing what he's doing. Very nice. Okay, so we have these two different primary questions. Regarding this reaction, I already mentioned the sage's response. Ramban focuses on the words, who is withheld from you? This makes it even worse. From you, not from me. I have children. You're the barren one. This is terrible. And Radak actually objects to the fact, says that Yaakov was objecting to the fact that she was attributing godly powers to him. And he was responding to that angrily. If you look at source 2 very quickly, Nechama Leibowitz says, herein surely lay the difference between superstition, idolatrous media of intercession, and the pure undefiled prayer of man to his maker. The former imagine they can bend the will of God, whether through the medium of sacrifices, charms, incantations, and other sorts of mumbo-jumbo. Just so long as man's purpose is to subject the divine to his own will, he is purely a sorcerer and a worshipper of idols. I'll just add in brackets, Nechama was very much against superstitions, you know, checking of mezuzahs when things go wrong, you know, boiling pieces of metal against the evil eye and what have you. She was a very strong rationalist. And that was why I think she likes what Radak says, because he's saying that Jacob is saying, what are you turning to me? And I've given this talk elsewhere. They've pointed out that Rachel was the one who took the trophim, those strange little, I don't know how you translate that. Household gods, like household goods, but just a little different. And that maybe she had a little bit of a superstitious bent and that Jacob didn't like that. But what's more interesting for our purposes today is what Rabbi Isaac Arama says. He suggests that Rachel was saying, he expands in a way that's very interesting and I think sounds extremely modern. Have a look at source 3. The two names, woman and Eve, indicate two purposes. The first name in Hebrew, Isha, similar to the word for man, Ish, teaches that woman was taken from man, stressing that like him, you may understand and advance in the intellectual and moral field, just as did the matriarchs and many righteous women and prophetesses, and as the literal meaning of Proverbs 31 about the Eshet Chayil indicates. The second alludes to the power of childbearing and rearing children, as indicated by the name Chava, Em Kol Chai, okay, Chava and Chai. A woman deprived of the power of childbearing will be deprived of the secondary purpose and be left with the ability to do evil or good like the man who is barren. Okay? Of both the barren man and woman, Yeshayahu states, I have given them in my house and in my walls a name that is better than sons and daughters, since the offspring of the righteous is certainly good deeds. Jacob was therefore angry with Rachel when she said, give me children or else I die, in order to reprimand her and make her understand this all-important principle that she was not dead as far as their joint purpose in life because she was childless, just the same as it would be in his case if he would have been childless. Okay, so in a very modern kind of way, he's saying, you know, women have two roles in life, and Rachel was completely ignoring the fact that alongside a woman and a potential mother, she was a human being who needed to do things in the world, just like a man does. And I have to say that I'm left with a little bit of a puzzle, because Rabbi Arama's words are wonderful, but they don't seem to relate to the actual words in the verse. You know, when Jacob turns around and goes, am I in God's stead who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? I can't see where in any of that textual phraseology there's any hint to this particular. And I'm curious whether anyone can solve, this is a genuine puzzle, I'm not just being rhetoric. Can anyone solve that for me? Do you see any hints to it in his words, in the words? Not as equal as he'd like to make out, if you actually look at the halacha. Interesting. Yes, Jay? Excellent. Hashem Elohim.
where that's where she's given the power to be a mother, perhaps. So he's saying, the role here of our relationship is the joint team, not the children, the Hashem.
Interesting, very creative. I invite you to develop that thought further. Could be, but as you can see, we're stretching. Like, I really can't see, having said to this gentleman over here that when we read text we should stay within the textual borders, I find Rabbi Arama, you know, out there with his insight, and I really would love to call him back up from the dead in order to ask him, you know, how this connects to the verse, although Nechama would kill me if I tried to call him up from the dead. So this piece really is a wonderful piece, and it left a deep impression on many of Nechama's students who decided to bring up their daughters with this kind of consciousness. Obviously, many also heard echoes of Nechama's own experience as a childless woman in this piece. She taught it often, and they thought that she was, you know, giving herself also meaning and organizing her life in a way that made sense. However, Nechama did confide that she in fact disagreed, feeling that a woman's primary role is to be a mother. And perhaps this is why she does not choose to end this essay in her studies with Arama's explanation. Instead, she brings the Midrashic opinion that I mentioned before, where the sages accuse Jacob of giving an unworthy answer to an appeal from an embittered and troubled soul. The Talmud says that he who teaches his friend's son Torah, it's as if he'd given birth to him. And Nechama's husband and others tried to persuade her that she had many spiritual children to whom she'd given birth. But she said explicitly she would have given it all up for a child. And when a delegation of Jewish women from the Women's Liberation Movement came to ask her to use her name to spearhead their movement, they were startled by her refusal. Writing books? That's nothing. Raising 6 children, now that's an achievement. If I had children, I would consider that more important than all my writings. So it's a little tragic, but quite sad on that level. Now, while Nechama frequently quoted her brother's statement, "The greatest revolution of the 20th century is the entrance of women into the world of learning," she herself shrugged off the label revolutionary with all her might. Perhaps she understood that it would alienate part of her audience, placing her outside the bounds of the traditional camp where she felt most comfortable. Or perhaps she genuinely did not believe herself to be a revolutionary. Examining what Nechama did in practice, the phrase evolution, not revolution, appears apt. Nechama built upon pre-existing materials, gradually and subtly making as few waves as possible. And my original title for this talk, which kind of got lost in the wash somehow, as you can see at the top of the page, is Innovation, Contribution, and Subtle Revolution. Nechama liked to be controversial, but within the parameters of what she defined for herself as acceptable orthodoxy. It's unlikely that this was a thought-out strategy. It probably stemmed from an intuitive sense of how to balance her various goals and beliefs. Professor Alice Shalvey, a well-known feminist, suggests that Nechama was an innovator, not a revolutionary. But even the label innovator would not have sat well with Nechama. She classified herself as a teacher, a role filled by religious women for centuries, familiar and safe territory. She also claimed that women's Torah learning was not new, and that had been going on for quite a while. And so even though she was doing things which really were quite new, because she strongly built on these pre-existent materials and did everything with subtlety, she succeeded in being accepted very widely across the spectrum. Her books contained no haskamot, no rabbinic stamps of approval, and yet they were widely accepted, except in the most far-right religious circles. Today, there are ultra-Orthodox rabbis who would never be able to admit that they studied with Nechama Leibowitz, and yet they did. Okay, and I heard this wonderful story, another little nugget that just came up, that there was a Haredi yeshiva student who liked to go and hear Nechama. The problem was when he would come home, he would not be able to quote her Torah because he didn't want to admit that he'd studied with a woman. So without Nechama knowing it, she was transformed into Reb Nachman. So Nechama's broad Torah knowledge, especially of classical rabbinical sources, her strict halachic observance, her exceptionally modest dress, her respectful and artless manner, all granted her a broad legitimacy and consensus. And with these passports in hand, Nechama helped to redefine what was considered a positive image for Jewish women. Female Torah scholarship was so close to all that was beloved and familiar, to the ideal of saintliness accepted for centuries in the male world, that it passed with barely a whisper of dissent. What, after all, could be objectionable about learning, teaching, promoting, and loving Torah? This was how Nechama presented it. She ignored the fact that this had always been the male ideal, and that the female one had always been different, focusing on modesty, good deeds, and rearing of children who would become Talmidei Chachamim. So Nechama may be given a good part of the credit for today's flourishing of women's Torah learning. Ironically, though, at times, she may have in a way made things more difficult for women, as complaints about obstacles to women's Torah learning are countered with, Nechama succeeded when women's learning was even less common, so why can't you? This brush-off refuses to address the fact that Nechama was Nechama. Leti Cotton Pogrubin calls this the Golda Meir syndrome, in which a great woman's achievements are used as proof of the non-existence of biases against women. The syndrome constitutes a widespread belief that any woman can get to the top if she wants to. Look at Golda! And that the only reason Israeli women haven't achieved more success in politics or in business is that they don't really want it. In reality, of course, the woman in question is unique for the good and the bad. Cotton Pogrubin reports that someone once retorted, "Yeah, but if you want to be a Golda, you'll have to divorce your husband and abandon your children like she did." Yeah, it's quite harif. Okay. Now, I do have a little more to say in the last few minutes, but I want to stop for a second and just take a couple of questions if you have. Yes, anyone want to ask or comment about Nechama Leibowitz? No questions?
Doing a good job yourself.
Okay, so let me just add one more topic. I'd like to return to the word innovator that came up earlier. It opens up a new window for us. Was Nechama really an innovator?
Of course.
Of course. Many of us would shout a resounding yes. And yet Nechama herself said no on more than one occasion, and she acted accordingly. And this was very strange. Okay? Now, I told you that at the time that Nechama began, the atmosphere in the Bible departments of universities was highly biblical critical. And on the other side of the fence, traditional Jews weren't doing very much analytical work. So it was either one of those two poles. And as I said to you, Nechama stepped into this vacuum. She was fairly allergic to a lot of the biblical critical theories, feeling that they were driven by anti-Semitic agendas, ignoring the nuances of Hebrew. She liked to tell the story of a famous German Bible scholar who came to a conference at the Hebrew University. She was asked to accompany him because she was a German speaker. The next session was, the professor was known as a specialist on the book of Ezekiel, and Nechama told him that a session on Ezekiel was beginning, and no doubt her professor would wish to attend. The latter's objection was most revealing. "But they are speaking in Hebrew, no?" He didn't understand Hebrew, so what was he doing studying Bible? Okay. So instead of applying her critical faculties in the biblical critical arena, she applied her analytical faculties and her fluency in Hebrew and her dedication to traditional Jewish sources to a non-biblical critical study of Jewish scriptures. And that was her work on the commentaries. She reframed them, she analyzed them, she organized them, specifically those of Rashi. She demonstrated the principles and philosophy behind the exegesis. And suddenly, what had previously been a jumble became crystal clear. To this day, teachers of Torah like myself owe her a great debt for making such material accessible and are to be found late at night riffling through her books searching for ready-made lessons. She's also, however, owed a debt of gratitude by academics because she redeemed many of the traditional commentaries from the musty attic to which they'd been relegated due to the predominance of the biblical critical school and the assumption that traditional commentaries must be primitive and have nothing to offer. So she brought them back in, even at Tel Aviv University, which was the bastion and still is the bastion of secular study. However, and we're not really going to have time to go through all these sources, I do want to tell you that her achievements go even further than just this shift. She did work on Midrash that was groundbreaking. The academic world in Nechama's day was very unenthusiastic about Midrash. It seemed to be a bunch of far-fetched parables that had nothing to do with anything. And yet Nechama would point out that the Midrash was sometimes a more careful reader of the text than the so-called literalists. And there are examples of that. Let's just take one example, skip to source 6. In Numbers 11:5, the Israelites say, We remember the fish which we ate in Egypt for free, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. Okay, so here's the Israelites. They've just emerged from slavery and they're going, oh, we remember the great food we ate in Egypt. It's very strange. And the Midrash makes it even stranger. It says, and look at source 7, we remember the fish. Does it say that the Egyptians actually gave them fish for free? Surely it's stated, now go and work, for no straw shall be given to you. If they did not give them straw for free, why would they give them fish for free? How then do I explain the term for free? It means free from divine commandments, free from the mitzvot. Okay, so the average reader, who normally, when you read the words for free in the verse, you're thinking without any money, without payment. And why does the Midrash then say free from the commandments? It seems odd. And this is where Nechama Leibowitz comes to our aid. And she loved the Midrash. She delved into it. She developed methodologies for studying it. And she would not have it be dismissed as these fantastic ramblings. And therefore, when it says for free, she's aware. She's aware of the difficulty here. She remarks that it does indeed sound far removed from their world of murmurings, but she actually accepts this Midrash more than any of the other commentators. She says, it seems that our rabbis evinced a profounder understanding of the Israelites' character. Perhaps this was merely the outward form their inner dissatisfaction took. When discontent lurks in the heart of the public or individual, grumblings and murmurings, criticism and defamation will flare up at the slightest pretext. Our sages detected this. They say something similar in the next verse, not in the next verse, you don't have it on your sheet. When Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, each in the door of his tent, and God is angry, the sages say that throughout their families means that they were actually concerned about sexual matter because their sexual practice was now limited by the newly imposed Torah law. So again, free from the commandments, from the halacha, from the limitations. And a student once asked Nechama in puzzlement why Rashi and the Midrash were talking about sexual matters when clearly in the context of people are grumbling because they have no food. Without batting an eyelash, Nechama replied, if you take a look at Freud's book, Civilization and Its Discontents, you will see that when people want to protest about something but can't, they will grumble about something else. That's what Rashi's trying to point out here. In other words, you know, what we look at and we say to ourselves, wow, you know, what strange readings these Chazal have. The Chama's assumption was, the sages were these brilliant people who wrote our Gemara, who had such brilliant legal minds, right? They weren't on some kind of, you know, drug or something that made them, you know, go so far away from the text and invent all these ramblings. They were reading the text and bouncing off it. Kind of, I'm going to turn to you again. You read a psychological interpretation, okay? You were sensing the tone of the text. And what I did was I turned you into a careful reader of the text by turning your attention to the fact that we could look at a particular letter and read it in. And that's what Nechama did. She wouldn't allow that the Midrash were completely separate from the text. She said, no, actually, it's reading the nuances. You look at the Midrash, and the Midrash says, what do you mean for free? Why on earth would the Egyptians give them food for free if even the straw wasn't free? So the Midrash has a good question. And the answer is not as weird as you think, because Freud, in the 20th century, showed us psychologically that this could be possible. Yes. I don't think it's defense. I think I was complimenting you. If you want to defend yourself against the compliment, you may do. Okay. This doesn't really matter which came first, because we have a dialogue with the... Uh-huh. Right, you're reading it from the context, are you saying? Yes, and that was another thing that Nechama did, and she said that the Midrash does. It's exactly what I'm talking about. I'm going to basically end here because we've run over time. If you want to ask a question, please come up to me at the end. Thank you very much, and Purim Sameach.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.